From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. It's time for our monthly science roundtable, and our connection this hour was made in the late 1960s at Stanford University. Psychologist Walter Mischel led a research project that became known as the Marshmallow Experiment. In these studies, researchers offered a child a choice between one small reward that the child could have immediately, typically one marshmallow, or two rewards that the child could have if they were willing to wait about 15 minutes, typically two marshmallows. Now, beyond the fascinating nature of watching young children wrestle with self-control, watching the clock tick as they debated whether they had the willpower to avoid eating the one marshmallow, the researchers were able to follow up in future years. They found that the children who were able to wait longer for the preferred rewards tended to have better life outcomes, higher SAT scores, higher educational achievements, better health, lower body fat, and other life measures. Self-control is a big problem for millions of us, whether it's walking past the cupcakes that your coworker made or throwing out your cigarettes. We're challenged with training our brains to make good decisions, and our Science Roundtable panel has been studying issues related to self-control, decision-making, addiction, and more. We're joined by Ben Hayden, a neuroscientist and assistant professor of brain and cognitive sciences at the University of Rochester. He runs the Hayden Lab there. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you, too.
Celeste Kidd's here. She's an assistant professor of brain and cognitive sciences at the University of Rochester. Celeste, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
On the phone is Dr. Jeffrey Williams, a professor of general medicine and associate professor of clinical and social psychology. Dr. Williams, thank you for joining us as well.
Great to be here.
Well, let's start with this, and I'll start with our panelists in studio and then kick it over to Dr. Williams. But what's the we've been having questions already from people online. What's the difference between having a problem with self-control and being actually addicted to something? Ben?
I think that's the million-dollar question. I think if we really knew the answer to that, we could make a lot of people a lot happier really quickly. We spend a lot of time thinking about that in the lab. I think probably the most useful way to think about it is to say that if this problem that you're facing is causing you distress or if it's causing your family distress, I think it's useful to call it an addiction. And whereas lack of self-control is a more general concept that could apply to other situations as well.
But there's certainly overlap in the field, to state the obvious.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, these are things that get debated at every single conference I go to. Every single time I have a faculty meeting, we talk about these types of very definitional questions.
And Celeste, it's not that we're talking about a distinction without a difference here. I mean, certainly there's a difference in a kind of a sliding scale. But does it matter if we classify something as addiction or a problem with self-control?
Sure. Well, also the my area is more in thinking about self-control and decisions more generally. Addiction falls usually more in a clinical domain, so I have less expertise in that area.
But when you think about it, is there a sense that definitionally we should care about the difference?
Well, it's important for as Ben alluded to. Figuring out, establishing when there's a problem that's going to depend upon the definition that you're using. So identifying exactly what that is is important.
And Dr. Williams, what do you think? And one of the reasons I ask about this is sometimes when we think about addiction versus self-control, there is a notion of powerlessness versus control being sort of in the throes of something that is more outside of your control, as opposed to sort of this idea that self-control is something that we have to do just a better job internally. What do you think about the difference?
Well, I even bring a different set of marshmallows to the table, shall we say.
yeah.
And that when I think about addictions, I treat a lot of people who are, we call dependent on nicotine or tobacco and smoking, or have a variety of medical issues that come up. So one of the things that we have created around this definition is someone dependent on it? If they're addicted, we also think of them having developed some identifiable problem, clinical problem, that comes with the behavior or with the pattern. And they also exhibit a tolerance, which means that they really need to do more and more of the behavior or the substance to get the same effect. So we look for a pattern when someone is addicted for that, and also for patterns of withdrawal. If they stop doing it, do they feel Do they feel worse? Do they exhibit a particular pattern of actually withdrawing from use of the substance? So that's how we look at it clinically with more the with the drug type of dependencies or addictions.
Is there a wider range of the different behaviors, activities, foods, substances that we can be addicted to, Dr. Williams, than we would have thought maybe 25 years ago? We hear more these days about addiction to, and we're going to talk about these things, addiction to sugar, addiction to sex, addiction to video games. And I don't know how valid all of those are. I haven't studied it in the way that you have, but are we seeing a wider range of things that we can be addicted to?
I'm probably going to turn that back over to the other two about that. I actually work more in the substance abuse areas of dependency and addiction than those. I also work in an area, though, of motivation, and we would refer to this, another way to think about that that control, self-control issue is around self-regulation is more the types of wording that we use about that is how is it that people go about regulating their behavior? We look at their psychological experience with that, and if it's a poor psychological experience, that suggests they're going to run into problems with those kind of things. So that's what I'll add to the mix so far.
Well, the Hayden Lab has examined the science behind self-control and looking at a wide range of common scenarios, including, say, having to choose from between a plate of cookies or a carrot. Your team, Ben, has sort of processed people's brain signals, displaying them on computers, getting a look. What are some of the things you found?
Well, what we find, I think, you know, going back to your question about the last 25 years, one of the biggest discoveries is now that we are able to really look inside people's brains in a way we weren't a couple generations ago, a lot of the things you're talking about, addiction to sugar, addiction to exercise, addiction to sex, these actually elicit a lot of the very same activation patterns in the brain as things like cocaine and heroin. And the more detail, you know, every year we get a little more detail and we can look at brains a little more accurately. And it's really amazing and remarkable just how at the chemical level, at the neural activity level, these things are very, very similar. Now, that doesn't mean that we should throw around the word addiction. It's a very charged word. But it means that we're getting closer and closer to the point where we're saying these things look the same, you know, and a lot of the same treatments are going to work as well, a lot of the same approaches to treating them.
If you're waiting on the phone already, and we've got a number of callers already, hang in there. We're going to get you in just a second, but we're trying to kind of create a baseline of understanding addiction, self-control, and some of these issues and some of the work that our guests have done. And so, Ben, just looking at some of your work online, it indicates that you can exercise your brain to improve its self-control in the same way that if you haven't done pull-ups and you try to do pull-ups, you may not be able to do one. But if you start doing them on a daily basis, over time you'll be able to do several and then a lot more. And I thought of the same way of our brain when it comes to self-control that your team is finding that you can sort of exercise it.
Yeah, that's right. You know, there's actually, we're kind of pursuing a two-pronged approach right now in the field. There's one is what we call behavioral interventions, which you bring somebody into the office. Usually this is with a therapist, and you kind of work and you kind of practice and you do little exercises. And then at the same time, the other prong is that we actually are trying to manipulate brain activity. We actually now have techniques for using electricity and magnetism, for example, to change at a very gross level people's brain activity. And those kinds of things are also seem to be having some success in improving self-control as well.
So you're doing those things in a lab, and yet most of our listeners are never going to end up being in the Hayden Lab. So I wonder if there are just ways to exercise our brains to do a better job at self-control, whether it is walking past. And as you say, there are some people who naturally can walk past a plate of cookies that your coworker made and not have an urge to grab them. And then there are some people who, in the way that Louis C.K. joked about, will go to get one and then make an excuse to go to get another and then make an excuse to walk by and go get a third. And then an hour later, they're hating themselves. So I guess some of us have different chemical makeup to start with, Ben?
Oh, that's absolutely true. I mean, I think, you know, we're also simultaneously having a revolution in genetics right now. We're starting to see there are just huge differences in the population. Even within the same family, you're going to have very, very different abilities to walk by that plate of cookies. I certainly have a lot of trouble doing it.
So do I.
So I wish, you know, I wish I was one of those people who wasn't tempted. But, yeah, so there's just big individual differences. And there's also differences even to people who might feel the same temptations are going to respond very differently to different types of interventions, different types of therapy, and whatever medical interventions you think of.
And so apart from coming to the Hayden Lab, if you're at home, what are some of the ways you start exercising your brain to do a better job at just having better self-control?
The first thing I would do if it were me and I was really trying to struggle with this is I would get a self-help book from Amazon and work through it chapter by chapter. You know, that's actually, there's a lot of evidence that says that self-help books are actually can be quite effective at that. And if that's not going to work, then I would recommend taking it up a level and getting a therapist, getting a recommendation for a good one.
There's another option too with the for the people at home. Angela Duckworth is somebody that I know has worked on this. Besides the so you called it exercising your brain or that sort of solution, there's also environmental changes that can be made. So for me, I don't know, I'm not sure what my chemical makeup is, but I'm somebody that has a really hard time not grabbing a handful of cookies if they're present. So I don't buy cookies or I put them up really high, so I have to go get a ladder.
But sometimes your coworker does. I mean, this newsroom has an epidemic of it. They call it the W. They warned me in January that I was going to have the WXXI 15, like the freshman 15.
Right.
It's just constant presence.
Yeah.
And you've got to regulate. So sometimes you can make sure that, like you say, you're not putting yourself in that position. But sometimes it's less in your control.
Yeah, you'd be surprised if there's something that you're struggling with. Angela Duckworth has been researching how effective making environmental changes to reduce the amount of temptation that's present in the environment are. And what her and her research group have found is small changes that you might think wouldn't definitively stop you from making that choice if you wanted to, seem to be very effective in causing you to take another moment and reducing the amount of times that you give in. So, for example, she gave the example of her teenage daughter who thought that she was spending too much time texting and on Facebook with her friends on her phone and wanted to study, but kept having that temptation there when she was doing her schoolwork. So her repair was turning off her cell phone. Of course, if she had wanted to use her cell phone, she could turn it back on. So those sorts of things. So maybe there's cookie present, you don't look at them, or you know that you like something else better. So I know personally I really like raspberries, so I keep them in I keep a lot on hand at all times. So when there's cookies present, I can eat the raspberries instead. There's a lot of research suggesting that being aware of what's tempting and thinking of ways that you can alter your environment in order to reduce how tempting that is can be very effective also.
You're hearing from Celeste Kidd, who is an assistant professor of brain and cognitive sciences at the University of Rochester, and she has done a lot of work with children. So, Celeste, I have a 2-year-old.
Yep.
And I'm curious to know if it's too early to start trying to train him to have better self-control. We opened the hour by talking about the marshmallow experiment and the notion that years later they found that the kids who had better self-control, even at younger ages, had better life outcomes later down the line. So what's too early to actually start thinking about that?
So I don't know if I am convinced yet, given the data we have, that doing something like training up your self-control is effective or worth it. So one possible interpretation of the longitudinal measures, kids who tended to be able to delay gratification and wait to have a second marshmallow after the 15 minutes grew up to be the kind of kids that did well on their SATs and, had better life outcomes generally. One possible interpretation of that is that there were differences in the capacity for self-control. Kids that are the kind of kids who can wait for the second marshmallow grow up to be the kind of kids that can wait and not watch TV in lieu of studying for their SATs or something like this. But another possible interpretation is that the marshmallow task was actually measuring something about the kids' expectations and beliefs about whether waiting was worth it or not in general. You can imagine that a kid that has a very unreliable is in an unreliable situation. If the future is unpredictable, you want to go for short-term outcomes that are guaranteed as opposed to delaying and waiting later. So one of the implications of the research that we've done in the baby lab is that kids will make the decision that makes sense given their beliefs and expectations about what's going on now.
I love the way you followed up with the marshmallow experiment from the famous one from the 60s. It's had so many sort of little branched off little permutations over the years. But what at the University of Rochester, what Celeste was just describing, as I understand it, is you take a child and first what you did was you offered him something not food related and you had a control group and a variable group. And well, tell
right.
me how
what, right.
what
so,
happened
so,
there.
Well, we were interested in testing that hypothesis that the beliefs and expectations play a role in the child's, I was like, I don't know if it's ability to delay gratification, but whether or not they delay gratification. So we assign kids randomly to one of two conditions, either the reliable condition or the unreliable condition. And then we had a cover task that we did before, the art task, to give them evidence about whether this environment is one where waiting tends to pay off or whether waiting tends to not pay off. So mm-hmm. they did an art task where they were given a choice between an immediately available low-value art material like crayons, or if they wanted to wait, they were told that we had more better art materials available.
You got a big bin of great stuff
right,
coming.
Right, right.
Yes.
And if they were in the reliable condition, they waited, they got the better stuff, and then we did the marshmallow task. Or if they were in the unreliable condition, the experimenter came back and apologized and said, I'm sorry, we made an error, but you can still play with these crayons. So when you did that, the kids who had been led to believe that waiting is worth it waited. I was like, overwhelmingly.
They were willing to wait for the marshmallow.
Even the little ones, yeah. In the initial, the original marshmallow task experiments, little kids had a very hard time waiting and almost never did. But when you gave them evidence that waiting is worth it, they waited the whole 15 minutes. They struggled with it looked like, but.
and then yet in this other group where you had, you started the experiment by telling kids, hey, you got these sort of dinky little crayons, but if you just wait, we're going to come back with this bonanza of great art tools. And then all of a sudden the researcher would come back and I'm thanks for waiting, but turns out we didn't have anything. Well, what do you expect when you then tell them, you can have this one marshmallow now, but if you wait 15 minutes, they just had this experience that said it's not reliable. And
so
I would never blame them. I would, frankly, I think I myself may question whether I want to wait.
Yeah, so there was one child who, when presented with this choice, said he did want to wait for the second marshmallows, but he said, you better have two marshmallows.
As in, like, you burned me once.
Right, right. It's like, he's like, I'm aware that this is not, I'm just going to try adding a little verbal pressure. And he ended up eating it very quickly anyway. So I was like, I guess he decided once she walked out of the room. So I think this is good news for parents because it may suggest that you may not need to train your child. They make sensible decisions based on the evidence. So if you want your child to wait and you're providing some motivation, making sure that you are reliable in delivering whatever you provide as the motivation as promised is all you need to do. You don't need to do much more than that.
And let me ask a question that may be obvious, but I will ask anyway, because I have a friend of mine who's a parent, and he says to me so many times, it's so important not to cave, but there are so many moments where it's just easier to cave. You know, for example, you'll say, you know, hey, if you can behave, you know, I'll give you a cookie later. And the kid is acting up and you just want them to behave, and finally you just hand them a cookie. To me, that would be the worst thing you can do is to do that, even though it's difficult. For example, if you were to tell the child, you get one marshmallow right now, or if you're willing to wait, you'll have two. And if that kid scarfs it right in front of you, and yet you hand him a second anyway,
they
good luck
quickly,
ever expecting them to wait, right?
Right, right.
So as obvious that is, I think these experiments just confirm that part of it.
Yeah, and I don't think that this. I think it would be very silly to say that there was no variance in people in terms of their ability to delay gratification, except for tracking the statistics in their environment. We know that that's not true. We know that there's variability to the other levels too. But based on the findings from that study, the environmental statistics are they push kids' decisions around quite a bit. So that can be a very powerful cue.
It gives me such confidence that, honestly,
and I hope that increases your motivation for holding off on the second cookie. It's like, you know that by doing this long term, you're going to be able to maintain more control over the situation. It's like, if you're just reliable and only say what you mean to carry through and then carry through with what you said.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt this experiment that you've done at the Baby Lab definitely confirms the notion that kids can be trained to understand the value of patience, and that even if they struggle with it, and I still struggle with it. So anyway, let's start to get to some of the phone calls, and there we have so much more to get to. We're going to be talking about free will. Dr. Williams has talked about smoking and addiction and other issues there. There's so much to get to, but I want to start by grabbing a phone call first here. Hold on a second. Now the host is, oh boy. All right, let me fix this. There we go. Okay, I want to grab our first caller, who just dropped out. We lost our first caller. So let's grab Bernard in Fairport. Go ahead, Bernard.
Thank you. On the marshmallow experiment, it seems to me that the real reason that many children went for the two wasn't for the two marshmallows. it was to appeal to the person because of the complex, if you will, instructions, so that they felt that they were more satisfying the person they were dealing with than getting two marshmallows. But that's just my opinion. My question really is about the purpose of studying self-control. The implication is we're studying self-control so that we avoid smoking, we avoid eating, et cetera, et cetera. But it seems to me that a bigger purpose for studying self-control is for the marketing people who want to understand how to use self-control to improve our economy. And so, you know, I'd be interested in your comments on that. What's the purpose of neurology studying self-control? Is it for the benefit of the individual, or is it for the benefit of our society? Thank you very much.
Thanks, Bernard.
Well, there's a lot of reasons. You know, we're basic scientists, so we have a lot of various motivations to study these things. But I can tell you that all the research that we're talking about here is funded by the National Institutes of Health, which is charged by the government with improving the health of Americans. And so every single thing we do is approved by, you know, is proposed to and approved by people who are only looking at whether this is going to improve people's health. Whether it also improves the economy of the country as well, that is also a really good thing to think about. But fundamentally, it's the health is the goal here.
I think our guests agree on that. And thank you, Bernard, for the call. This is Daniel Morris, the clinical director of the, and I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, it's the Kavod Addiction Recovery. Is that correct, Daniel?
Hey, Devin. Yes, that was excellent. Perfect. Yes, I'm the clinic director here, and I was listening to the discussion about addiction definition, and I'd like to just kick in here if I could. Would that be all right?
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
I mean, generally, there are three behavioral general conditions that people look at when they talk about addiction. And one is loss of control or compulsivity, otherwise known as powerlessness. Continuation despite adverse consequences, that is, unmanageability, obsession, and or preoccupation. In other words, you're driving down the road, you're on your way home, and you begin to think about your favorite addiction. It just intrudes into your thinking. Those are three behavioral conditions, and we see that all the time here over at Kavod.
Well, tell us what you do at Kavod. Daniel, tell us what you do at Kavod.
Well, I'm the clinic director, and we're a comprehensive sex addiction rehab, meaning people come here, the sex addict and their partner or their wife, And we provide treatment that's comprehensive. So the immediate work is to help people get abstinence from the addiction. So we have tremendous amount of experience doing this kind of work. And so the work is to get abstinence quickly. So we have a lot of understanding about the problem of compulsivity or powerlessness and what needs to happen for people when they present with those kind of conditions.
Well, you use the term powerlessness, and I think this is one part of the debate, and eventually I'd like to bring Dr. Williams back into this part of the discussion because I've heard this come up. We could spend, and we're not going to this hour because it's just too much, but we could spend an hour talking about 12-step programs, and in the future maybe we will. I had a great email exchange with one of our listeners about that some weeks back. And there's a new book about AA that's out right now about addiction. And one of the criticisms is that the notion of powerlessness takes away from the individual the notion that they can regain control. And so I'm curious to know, Daniel, what you tell people about powerlessness.
Okay, great question. Powerlessness is narrowly defined as the inability to stop the behavior on their own. Modify behavior or to end the behavior, they must ask for help or get help. Without help, they can't control themselves. I think you see that clearly with all kinds of addictions. The addictions that people are most aware of probably would be like heroin use or cocaine use. Sex addiction is actually one of those addictions that requires, once the addiction is present, where people require significant help.
Okay,
help in the form Yeah.
Well, let me jump in and ask, because, again, I could probably spend the whole hour on sex addiction, and maybe in the future we'll do that, Daniel, and I appreciate you calling. When you talk about powerlessness there, let's say someone is addicted to sex, or their powerlessness over the notion of sex, that it's an addiction. Does that mean they will never have power or control over the concept of sex again in their life?
What people need to do if they have an addiction is to work a program. A program is a systematic practice that is enacted day in and day out. It's like if you had diabetes, you would have to take medicine for it every day. The idea is that addiction is a disease process. And by the way, I have right here in front of me the definition of addiction from the American Society of Addiction Medicine. You want to hear it?
Go ahead.
Short definition of addiction is: addiction is a primary chronic disease of brain reward, motivation, memory, and related circuitry. Dysfunction in these circuits leads to characteristic biological, psychological, social, and spiritual manifestations. This is reflected in an individual pathologically pursuing reward and or relief by substance use and other behaviors. They go on, but that's as far as I'll go right now. Pathological conditions, meaning that people do the behavior despite adverse consequences. Their judgment ability is impaired. So recovery is always about restoring their ability to make good judgments. That's a process.
I certainly understand it, but what's the short answer? If you're powerless over sex right now, can you regain power over it?
The short answer is you need to get help so that you can begin to use good judgment. Did that answer your question? In other words, I mean, it's not a simple answer of regaining power over the behavior. The behavior, if it's addiction, the addiction will be there for the rest of your life.
Okay.
That's the understanding. So you have to do stuff every day to get healthy.
Daniel, thanks for taking the time to call us. That's Daniel Morris, the clinical director of the Kavod Addiction Recovery, talking about sex addiction. And there are some similar threads. Dr. Williams, you've spent a lot of time looking at smoking and working with smoking addicts. What do you tell people, especially those who come to you who have tried and failed? I've heard you say before, it can take 7, 8, 9 times for a smoking addict to actually kick it. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And thinking about some of the discussion, particularly around powerlessness, I hear that from people that come to see me all the time. And one of the things that we try to convey to them is that it takes a while to be able to learn to regulate yourself around this. It isn't these are sort of new pathways, in my opinion, about how people learn to regulate and change a behavior in a clinical area. Oftentimes, maybe the first time they're trying to get into this, in which case it's really all new. Somebody who's tried several times and failed, we look at psychological needs for areas of autonomy and competence, and there's another need for relatedness, all of which can be energizing and empowering to people when they begin to address this. Powerlessness specifically would be somebody who feels that they can't manage it anymore. They feel no confidence that they're going to be able to take the next step. So we try experiments. First step is for people to become more aware of their smoking or their eating behaviors. We have them document that for a while, and oftentimes they begin to start to regulate that quite naturally. But then we ask them to take experiments. Can you make it 15 minutes? Can you make it a half an hour or an hour, particularly at difficult times? And if they can get through those, that starts to build their sense of ability to do this. The issue of autonomy is more complex. It's about the issue of how much they want to do it for themselves, and do they have a good, do they feel there's an importance to it? We explore that and other reasons that they would value that, and we have them begin to develop that regulatory capacity.
And Dr. Williams, can I jump in here real quickly? In 2007, the University of Rochester put out a press release that immediately made me think of a movie scene that I would hesitate to call classic, but a lot of people have seen it, and it's from a movie called The Breakup with Vince Vaughn and Jennifer Aniston. And in it, a couple is arguing. They've had dinner. He's sitting on the couch playing video games, and she just wants him to do the dishes. And he says he doesn't want to do the dishes. He wants to relax, and he'll do them later. And finally, he says, okay, I'll do the dishes. And she says, no, I don't want you to do them. I want you to want to do the dishes. And his response is, why would I want to do the dishes? And oddly, that scene is about, it's hard to modify behavior if someone doesn't want to do it. They'll say they'll do it. And I don't know why, but that made me think of everything that you've talked about when it comes to smoking. And I would imagine the people who are successful actually want it.
Yeah, we think that that's very important for them to value pursuing that, both in the short, our studies have shown in the short term, which means even up to 6 months in the initiation of change, and then in terms of 2 to 3 year maintenance of cessation over time. It turns out the degree that they feel that they want to do this, it's not just want to do it, but want to do it for themselves, not for somebody else. That is autonomy, and that's actually getting away from the issue of self-control, but getting to the issue of self-determination. And there's a lot of positive affect and a lot of psychological energy that comes with approaching it from that perspective. They also need to deal with this issue of, do they feel able? Now, the person in the movie knew how to do the dishes, so I don't think that was the issue.
Yes.
So I think the issue is have the discussion. Well, let's stop and talk about why would you want to do the dishes? And start, but you have to start from their perspective. If Jennifer Aniston is making him do it and he still perceives that, that's going to be a form of control. Where the person that brought up the issue of, are we trying to help the economy? Are we being, are we controlling ourselves to help someone else? That's not really what we're talking about in terms of self-determination. We don't think that they can access the quality of energy they need to be able to sustain these long-term changes that they're going to need in their everyday life.
Before I get to a break, one more quick question for you, Dr. Williams, because we've had questions from listeners about this subject. I asked a similar question to the gentleman who called from the sex addiction clinic. The notion of, if you have an actual addiction to whether it's sex or alcohol or smoking, maybe sugar, etc., can you eventually function in the future with that as part of your life, or do you need to abandon that going forward? What have we seen?
I think the food stuff answers the question. You have to.
Yeah, you can't get away from, largely it's hard to get away from sugar, yes.
The issue of around the other substances, alcohol and nicotine, we know very clearly that people get rapidly re-addicted if they go back. And that the things that made them vulnerable, even on a genetic level, are still active and in place, and then any changes that occurred from the previous patterns of behaviors that they were in their brain. So I think they're always at increased risk to go back, but there are certain places where you really have to continue the behavior to live, right? So if you're going to eat, you've got to learn to regulate and moderate the amount that you're taking in if you're going to maintain the change. I am also open to the other two.
Yeah.
Comment on that.
Okay. Well, why don't we do this? Since I'm way late for a break by about 10 minutes, we're going to take the shortest break in radio, come right back, stay here on this subject, and we're also going to talk to our guests about whether, if you can be addicted to behaviors that we don't want, can you train yourself to become addicted to things like exercise or good foods, etc.? And the Hayden Lab has looked at that. I'm curious to know what we think about that. Coming right back, this is our monthly science roundtable with three panelists from the University of Rochester. You're listening to member-supported public radio. Coming up in our second hour, how to improve graduation rates in the city of Rochester. One program is doing its part, helping kids learn to work and hold a steady job on their way to a diploma. We'll meet success stories from the Hillside Work Scholarship Connection, and we'll take your thoughts on how to give students a better shot at graduation and success. That's next hour on Connections.
On the next Fresh Air, Denzel Washington and LaTanya Richardson Jackson. They're co-starring on Broadway in A Raisin in the Sun. Washington plays the role originated by Sidney Poitier, who he went to for advice.
He was funny because he was like, I'm not going to tell you what to do. And then he'd start trying to remember lines.
Join us.
Fresh Air tonight at 7 o'clock, right here on your public radio station, WXXI and WEOS.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. And on this Monday afternoon, we're talking about the science of addiction, self-control, self-regulation, willpower, etc. And our guests are well-equipped to help us with that. Ben Hayden is a neuroscientist and assistant professor of brain and cognitive sciences at the U of R. He runs the Hayden Lab. I love that. I love the Hayden Lab. I want to visit the Hayden Lab. Celeste Kidd is an assistant professor of brain and cognitive sciences and works in the Baby Lab. Again, is there a happier place?
You have a 2-year-old, so you could visit the
baby
lab.
I know. Is there a happier place than a baby lab?
I love it. So, as a kid, seemed to love it.
Yes. And Dr. Jeffrey Williams is on the phone with us, a professor of general medicine who has looked at addiction, substance abuse, smoking, and other issues as well. And a friend of mine recently remarked that it is a fault of evolution that we crave sugar and fats and sweets. She said it's bizarre that our bodies are not designed to crave and get addicted to things like raw vegetables. So, watching some of the videos from the Hayden Lab online, you know, I know you've looked at the way the body responds to certain things, Ben, and I'm curious to know if you think we can train our bodies to become addicted to the things that are good for us, whether it's exercise, raw vegetables, and other things.
I think we can. You know, a lot of people, I think, just have that kind of addictive personality, and a lot of them are really able. It's very effective, and it's very they're able to kind of transition to being addicted to exercise, which is often good if you don't take it too far, to things like serving the community or helping other people, or you know, even doing your job more effectively. If you can keep that in check, oftentimes that satisfies those same cravings that helps distract people from whatever their demons are that are causing them to be addicted. And so it's not always easy for everybody, but some people can do it. And I think a lot of people you see out in the world are people who would be addicted to alcohol or cigarettes or whatever if they hadn't figured out in the past how to make that transition.
Also want to just talk about just general willpower and decision making. And I have a clip I'd like to play if we could. It comes from Dan Ariely, who is an Israeli-American professor of psychology and behavioral economics who teaches at Duke University. And he was talking about self-control in a TEDx talk. Maybe we think about it in cases that are either sort of extreme or very obvious, you know, whether it's cookies versus carrots or smoking addiction, you know, that kind of a thing. But in this TEDx talk, Dan Ariely spoke about self-control that so many of us struggle with on a daily basis, but maybe we don't think of it in self-control, and we should. Let's listen.
How many people here have ever texted while driving? I mean, it's an incredible thing, right? And you say, it's not the case that you said to yourself, how much do I enjoy living? How much do I not want to kill other people? How important is this text message right now? And you said, yes, let me do that. No. Instead, what happened is that the impulse to answer this vibrating phone or to answer the ring overtakes us, and we do lots of bad things.
So again, that's Dan Ariely, a professor of psychology and behavioral economics, talking about our bad decision-making or our just inability to ignore a buzzing cell phone even when we're driving. And I want to start with Celeste on this question because my 2-year-old is amazingly adept at the phone. But what I love about him for now is yeah. that when our phone rings, he says, Mommy, Daddy, turn it off. Put it in the pocket. Mm-hmm. But peers who are a little older, his mm-hmm. friends who are 4, 5, and 6, now know how to operate these machines, and they're growing up with
sure.
it. And I'm concerned that they're going to grow up in a world where they're always on it and they're not able to make good
right.
decisions. What do you think
well,
about
Well, so I don't know. So the there's all sorts of concerns about kids growing up with touchscreen devices. And I think a lot of the concerns are actually shouldn't be so concerning. I was like, it's although touchscreen technology is like smartphones are a new thing. Devices like that, I was like, new ways that kids can interact with things is not, that's not new. And I think that can only be positive up until the point that it takes away from other experiences. So touchscreen devices are interesting, and we're just actually starting to use them in the baby lab to do research because it used to be the case that you couldn't test kids on a computer because they were missing the motor development. You can now kids who are too young to be able to adequately manipulate puzzle pieces could still get the conceptual experience of putting together a puzzle on a touchscreen device because it doesn't require as much fine motor. There's lots of potential that I think is not being talked about as much in terms of good things that these sorts of
devices could bring. We're too negative
about it. Right, right. In terms of the addiction, so teenagers, was very concerned observing teenagers texting while driving when I know because they're a teenager and presumably they haven't been driving since they're very young, this is a new experience. I thought this was going to be the downfall of all of us, is that we were all going to die because of this. Teenagers tend to be very social. This place is a high – this is something that they have a high value for. One of the things that's missing – in a young child or a teenager in this case, is an understanding of what exactly the dangers are. So while that clip you played I think is really great, it's true that we don't explicitly, overtly compute what the risk is that we'll die if we text. Adults are more aware of the risk than kids are, and I think that's one of the reasons why it happens more. So making young people aware of what the downsides are. I don't know if anybody who's listening does this sort of research, but I've thought for a long time it would be really great if when kids were learning how to drive, we did. One of the problems with what makes texting dangerous is that you're attending to the text, so you're not attending to the road. But one of the sort of catch-22s of attention is if you're not attending, you can't possibly notice that you've become a worse driver. But we have driving simulators. So I know that for myself, I've played around with them before. And if we just had teenagers text while driving in a driving simulator and then after the fact played back for them their driving performance, you feel like you are just fine, like you drove the same way that you did when you were not texting. But if you see it after the fact when you're no longer distracted by the text, you could be made more aware of the dangers. So
what Celeste is talking about, and I want to bring Dr. Williams back in, is this notion of making people aware of just kind of a danger. I mean, kids may not realize that I'm a terrible driver when I'm texting until they hurt somebody.
You can push those values around. Yeah, and doing it in advance of hurting somebody or yourself would be ideal,
obviously. Yeah, but Dr. Williams' work has indicated that roughly 450,000 people a year die from smoking in the United States, and by the year 2030, smoking is on track to be the number one cause of death around the world. Smokers live on average about 15 years less than non-smokers, and we know it now, Dr. Williams. This is not 1940 or 50 or whatever. That we know it now. Celeste is talking about the fact that kids are going to grow up and it will be drilled into them that when you text, you're not only a terrible driver, but people die every year. And yet we still do these things. Dr. Williams, are we just not good at understanding consequences?
I would say you're in the wrong area of what the person's experience is about. You're trying to talk about this as if it's logical. And the reason people do these things is in part emotional. The example I'll give is specifically about smoking, but it probably applies for these other things, is people smoke to regulate their emotions. And they smoke when they get cues from their brain that they're withdrawing from the nicotine. They don't have it in place to calm them down, to make them feel more comfortable, and to deal and cope with the stresses they've had. The example I'll use is I have worked with lots of healthcare workers who have smoked and quit smoking and have gone back to the funeral of their parents and relapsed to smoking at that point of a parent who died from a smoking-related disease. You just can't understand that in any kind of a logical pattern. It has to be that they're working on the emotional level to deal with how they're feeling at the time. And I think that we can't always connect just what we're thinking to what we're doing in our behaviors, particularly around these things that are addictive. So we try to, I ask people to sort of suspend that logical model. People are highly critical of themselves about failure because they think because they know it, just from all the things you just said, it's drilled into me, I should know this, I should feel better. They feel badly, and when they feel badly, they actually want to smoke more. It brings on the cravings. It brings on the desire for, it potentiates, if you will, the addiction or the symptoms that the person is trying to relate to them. So we want to bring that to their awareness, that this is actually, it's not such a logical issue. And that in many ways, the answer comes from the positive answer, the feeling positive about the small successes they have, rather than judging themselves, trying to, and this is the difference between self-control, where people can be quite negative to themselves. We want them to find the positive side of the changes that they've made and embrace those, because there's probably going to be less of the behavior in it at that point.
We only have about 6-7 minutes left here in our discussion on the science of our behaviors, and on our monthly science roundtable. Maybe we should have done 2 hours on it with Dr. Jeff Williams, who you're hearing on the phone, Celeste Kidd, and Ben Hayden from the University of Rochester, the Hayden Lab, and from the Baby Lab, and talking about all the things that we are learning about the way our brains work and our behaviors are governed. An interesting discussion is whether we're actually governing our behaviors at all, and whether free will is real. And that's one thing that the Hayden Lab has sort of, I don't want to say had some fun with, but I think it's a very interesting question, Ben, the notion of, are we actually governing ourselves with free will and choices or not? And this is the subject of a new book by philosopher Sam Harris called Free Will. Not even all of his colleagues agree with it, but he attacks the notion that our choices are truly free, and he looks at the difference between compatibilism and incompatibilism. What are we talking about there?
Well, the idea of compatibilism is basically saying that it's possible that we have free will, and yet, even so, all of our actions are kind of determined by the laws of physics at a fundamental level. Those two ideas that a lot of people feel like just are completely incompatible with each other, those are compatible. That's what some philosophers are saying. That's what Harris's rival Daniel Dennett is claiming as well. He says that it's okay for the laws of physics to determine everything and yet to also claim that we have free will. Harris, I think, is saying the opposite. He's saying those are incompatible. So he's an incompatibilist. He's saying you can't have one and also have the other at the same time. You either have to accept that all the laws of physics are determining everything we do, or you have to say that it's possible you have free will.
But if we accept Harris's point of view, I've heard him speak. He's been on this program before. He's not generally somebody who would his conclusion is not that therefore we are all victims of a world in which we don't have free will. I think it's more understanding the way ostensible choices are made. But what's the ramifications if we accept Harris's point of view, Ben, if we say we're not actually engaging in what we think is free will?
Well, you know, I'm a scientist, not a philosopher, and my opinion is the ramifications are actually pretty small. I think these guys are kind of splitting hairs here. I think they're really ultimately what they're doing is they're just debating definitions of words.
Okay.
And if you could really get them to sit in a room, maybe have over some wine, talk for a few hours about their definitions, come to an agreement about those definitions, I think that they would find that a lot of their disagreements dissolve.
Celeste, you're nodding as well.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. There's all sorts of cases in which what we feel like we have experienced and how we know that it works are not they don't seem to jibe, but they do. And so an example is attention. You can only track a few things in your environment, but I feel like as I'm sitting here, I can perceive the entire room at once. It's actually top-down knowledge that's sort of giving me that illusion. I'm only able to perceive very few low-level cues about color and shape, really. So I agree with Ben. I don't think that they disagree as much as they think that they do. I think a lot of it is definitional. And what you mean by free will and what you mean well, actually, it's mostly free will that I guess is driving that conflict.
Yeah, or maybe to put it differently, maybe they do really disagree and they have a lot of strong disagreements. I just think it's not that important, especially
right.
if we're trying to come up with a cure for smoking. I don't think that coming up, if they debated for 20 years and we found out who won the debate now, that's not going to really help us one way or the other to try to cure smoking as an addiction.
You can think of it, you can take multiple different, you can approach the same problem from multiple different angles, and I think that that's what the implication is. So you can either do what Ben does and study the neural underpinnings of a decision-making choice, or you can take a more high-level cognition approach to it and think about things like the motivation and your understanding of the reward sizes. But either way, as like the solving the problem, you should look at both perspectives.
Well, let's wrap our monthly science roundtable, and I've literally got about a minute left here, so maybe 20 seconds each. I've been so fascinated by the research that all of our panelists at the University of Rochester today have been doing. What are you working on now, Celeste?
A lot of decision-making and attention stuff, and we're always in need of subjects. So if anybody has a child, it's like we don't just study babies, we study kids too. They can sign up at rochester.edu/babylab for studies.
And check out the video and all the different great things they've been doing there. I love what you've
and
been
doing. And we're expanding, so we'll have even more studies in the future.
Ben, what's going on at Hayden Lab?
We're trying to basically take some ideas from electrical engineering, believe it or not, and build circuit models of the brain that actually predict some of the types of things that we see in people, either have good or bad self-control, and try to figure out where in the circuit something is going wrong using those principles.
And Dr. Williams, what's keeping you busy these days?
We're trying to look at how people perceive risk around cardiovascular disease for smoking and cholesterol, and particularly about how that's perceived, how that may relate to whether they take medications regularly to manage this or help them quit smoking in the long term.
Thank you for your time, and thanks for taking the hour for us, Dr. Williams. Nice to talk to you.
Great. Wonderful to be here.
Ben Hayden, Celeste Kidd, again, could have done an extra hour on this, but we'll revisit the subject, and I know your research continues with so much more to bring to us. So we'll bring you back here, and thank you for being here for our Science
Roundtable.
Thank you
for having us.
Thank you very much.
All right, and thanks to our listeners as well. Short break, and we come back looking at not only the graduation rate in the city of Rochester, but a new national number that puts the national high school graduation rate over 80%. How is Rochester going to move toward that number? What's one of the big successful programs that we can tell you about? We're going to share some success stories next on Connections.